From Southern California, this is The Circle of Insight, a show about everything in psychology. Hear the latest in news and views on psychology. Our motto is simple. Wherever there is psychology involved, we are there. And now, here's your host of The Circle of Insight, Carlos Vasquez.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We have a great show today. We're going to be exploring the biology and the hereditary factors of prayer and religion with Dr. Spilka. Dr. Bernard Spilka is Professor Emeritus of the Psychology Department at the University of Denver. Welcome to The Circle, Dr. Spilka.
Thank you.
So, I know last show we talked a lot about prayer and a lot of different aspects about prayer. Today we're going to start looking into more, how would you say, the hard science of prayer, looking into biology and hereditary factors, maybe even about religion. So what is something that really stands out for you in regards to the biology of prayer?
Well, it's not just the biology of prayer. I think we'd have to put it back in the context of religion in general. And the last I looked, there were 9 different studies looking at whether prayer is, well, let's say prayer and religion might have some kind of a genetic component. Is it strictly a product of learning in your home, or is it something beyond that? Now, it is possible when you study identical and fraternal twins to be able to compute the proportion, we'll say. I won't get into the language, got to avoid some of the fancy statistical language, which is more obscuring than clarifying. But you are able then to indicate the proportion of religion that you can, individual faith, that you can refer to heredity, or you can refer to environment. Now, these studies are usually very large studies. They may have 10,000, 20,000 people in the studies. Places like Denmark and Sweden and so forth, everybody gets measured on lots and lots of different things. And of course, for medicine or whatever else, and psychological behaviors, you want to know what's controlled by, say, genes, DNA, RNA, and so forth. Well, in this case, in 1997, I had the good fortune to be one of a number of authors of a study which went over and reviewed 8 different studies dealing with heredity and environment, and found out that basically anywhere from about 10% to 50% of religiosity is referable to heredity.
Really?
And that was a terrific shock to see this. Now, when I went over and looked at this stuff in detail, I was only pleased, I'd say, with 1 or 2 studies. Now, I understand there's some better ones since then, but I haven't, you know, been back looking in detail for them. It's, however, generally accepted that there is this genetic component, but what it actually is in religion, no one can really definitively say. They haven't been able to identify any genes specifically with it, any DNA patterns or whatever with it. But then we have to face the fact that we're talking about a phenomenon that is actually worldwide. I don't believe anyone has ever found any people without what we would think is some kind of faith. It may be that they have, they would like to use the word spirituality because we recognize what is done in the South Pacific is not what is done in, let's say, Irvine, California. There's a difference. And all Well, the thing is, we have a worldwide phenomenon. When something is universal, well, then you're going to look for something which is much more basic or genetic. And what is the basis of genetics? If we go back, we're looking now at evolution. And evolution is concerned with natural selection, meaning that these are the organisms that survive. We are the products of the people who made it, in terms of living. The problem is, we know there are lots and lots of physiological conditions which eliminate you very early in life, and some of these can be determined prior to birth. And when they find this prior to birth, they may abort. For example, condition like Tay-Sachs disease, which is a pretty general inherited disorder. Well, about 1963, they discovered the nature of the genetic defect. Now, it's a recessive disease, which meant that when two parents, each of which had the defect, in other words, your DNA is in two strands, and one of them might have a place that's bad, and the other one's okay. When you go with these two people, and let's say they were supposed to have lots of kids, 25% would have the defect fully. 25% would be carriers, and 25% would be perfectly clean on something like that. So that's very nice. There are further implications of some of this with the carriers and some real arguments as to intelligence and such. But anyway, when you get this, we're saying natural selection means you're increasing the probability of a generation of people who can reproduce. And you're eliminating those who will not reproduce and such. It's easier for us to think about that with respect to animals rather than humans. Humans don't listen very well to nature in this sense. And of course, you try to tell somebody, no, you can't have children. They're not going to be very happy with you. And then they'll come out and they'll have children. And you know what? It may be perfectly okay, because there's a lot of that. And now, of course, we have another thing called epigenetics sitting on top, but I won't get into it. It just means that what your great-grandmother had for supper or something will can affect you.
Oh, wow.
That's like Lamarck and like Lysenko, the Soviet one, that your experiences in life, they don't change the DNA. They were all saying, but what it does is DNA, groups of DNA, millions of these, what they call base pairs, they form genes. And these genes, some of them are turned off, some are turned on. And that's what the epigenetics is concerned about. So it's a whole new thing. Now, it seems to me we need some work in terms of studying, for example, people who are, say, non-religious as opposed to highly religious, and see if we can find any kind of genetic patterns involved in this. I don't know if we will. This may be strictly something that is learned. In other words, even though we're saying there's a genetic component, we don't have any idea what it is.
Hi, welcome to Adelante. This is is Adelante Recovery, and my name is Yvette Kuglin, and I'm part of the staff.
Adelante Recovery Center has helped people in dual diagnosis for 5 years. We accept most PPO insurances and provide luxury accommodations and 24-hour support. To speak with an admissions counselor, call 1-888-242-4450.
A lot of time, we don't even know what's wrong with us, and sometimes we need to get away to figure that out. So if you want to go for a little retreat out in Corona Del Mar, which is a confidential location, we're here to help. So we're only a phone call away. Thank you.
I've read some studies where prayer can have an impact, or I'm not sure if it's the prayer or the actual belief in God, they can have a lot of physiological benefits. We've seen people who are terminal, or so-called terminal, and they do much better when they believe in an afterlife. Did you see any, what other studies have you found that prayer or maybe religion have physiological benefits?
Oh, I think that that's probably quite true. I did studies for a number of years dealing with death and dying, and especially the psychological state of people in terms of relative to religion. And what we found pretty much was people who are highly religious show consistently less fear of death and dying. Well, fear is manifested physiologically through the expression of anxiety. Your blood pressure goes up, your muscle tension, these are all physiological effects. And in such a wide variety of such possibilities, somebody has a sensitive stomach, and it may be due because of anxiety to them. You know, it's like getting in a car with somebody who is terribly anxious about driving in the car. I could give you some great examples of that, but it's not perfect. Anyway, we know in this case, I suspect, well, we know for sure in another way. Take the Mormons. Mormons have a lot of rules about eating and what they eat, and against smoking, against coffee, and other things like that. They're healthier. They live longer. You can't get around some of these things in general. The more observant, well, they restrict themselves. I don't know. I just eat it. With me, it's, if it's food and it's in sight, I'll go grab it. We know that people who are highly religious may indeed feel more comfortable. But then again, I'm sure we can come up with some atheists who feel just as comfortable about it. You can read Stephen Jay Gould and Carl Sagan, and they're critics of religion. And there's plenty to criticize in a lot of the way religion is handled. In other words, it's not just religion is good and non-religion is bad. No, both of them can have their serious problems when it comes to people.
Now, I know off camera we talked a little bit, sticking with the physiological side, off camera we talked a little bit about the placebo effect, and you were telling me a very interesting, I think it was a study on the placebo effect. Could you reiterate that again for our audience?
Well, I'm thinking with placebos, it's a personality phenomenon. It's a belief phenomenon in most cases that can be measured. There are available the questionnaires that are measured so that theoretically when medications are supposed to be employed, you're supposed to use the real medication and in many cases something else, but the person may think it's the real medication. And what you find, and it, that's a 75% to 80% of the people respond favorably to the real medication, say. But when we go out, it's not uncommon to find 70 to 75% of people who get the phony medication also. You go out, say, and you have arthritis, and it says, go get glucosamine and chondroitin. Well, I've been amazed that people, some of the people who get it, benefit from it. But to me, and to the literature I read, it's a great placebo. And I have arthritis, and when the first time when I went to a new rheumatologist, he said, have you tried it? I said, look, if you're going to give me a placebo, make it a better one, one that's going to work. And he laughed because he knew, and he was being smart. He says, maybe with this person who walks in the door, a placebo will work. Well, I tried it. Didn't do a thing for me. But that's common.
Religion, too much knowledge can be actually a hindrance.
Well, religion may act as a placebo to many people. They believe it's going to have certain effects. And that's all that matters.
That's really fascinating. So placebo effects, physiological benefits, nothing has proven really that prayer can cure any kind of physiological ailment or anything like that, right?
It hasn't been proven, but you know that chances are, of all the people who pray, there are those who are going to physiologically benefit. They're going to feel better. They're believing they feel better. And it's what they can do. There are limits. Let's face it. You haven't been able to find a placebo that will fix a broken leg or anything like that. And I wouldn't try wandering around with a broken leg and say, well, I got this pill.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Spilka. That was great insight in the world of prayer and biology and physiology. I thank you, everyone, for joining us. Remember, our motto is simple. Wherever there's psychology involved, we are there. We'll see you next time, everyone.